Session number 12661, Mr. Jim Ray, reel 18.
Mr. Ray, reel 18. Had you taken over then, after the death of Peel, as platoon commander, or you'd be the senior surviving NCO, wouldn't you?
Well,
you'd be the senior NCO.
Yes, I said I took the command. I said, well, sir, I said I'm the senior NCO. I said I've got no platoon commander, so I assume I take over the platoon. He said, that's quite correct, Sergeant. He said, carry on. He said, and do the best you can.
Now, who were commanding the sections? Do you remember?
Not particularly.
Well, you were in the middle of a battle. I know it sounds daft to stop and think about it, but how were people performing in action, do you think? I mean, you don't need to give individual names if you don't want to, but were people doing well?
Oh, yes, because we were fighting for our lives. We knew we had to get down to... kill or be killed. We knew we had a massive force in front of us, and we were there. We weren't agitated. Every shot was accounted for. That was the sort of attitude we had.
Did you training, your regular training, I mean, was that valuable to you in I think, keeping control of yourselves and keeping yourself steady?
Well, Peter, training is different to the actual showdown. Inasmuch that I can't vouch for the men, how they felt, but I think they might be like themselves. First of all, you're partially afraid. You know, you had nerves. And once you overcome that nervousness, you got down to the business of saying, well, this is it. It only takes one shot. It's a good one. That's it. You've had it. As long as you're alive, you've got your target. That's when your training comes in. You don't fire at random at anything, you know. You fire at the target.
You were actually firing yourself, were you?
Oh yes, I wasn't standing around giving orders. I was there firing.
About what range were you firing at?
Oh, maybe it's about 150 yards.
So close.
Oh, yes.
You'd not expect to miss at that range, would you?
Oh. No. Every shot.
Were they just running towards you, or what were they doing?
Well, of course they were more upset than we were, milling around, you know, wondering where we were, because we were in good cover. We had good cover, you see. We weren't exposing ourselves. Oh, yes.
So the instruction was not just to spray, but to fire. It was individual aimed shots.
That's right.
And was everyone was doing that?
Everyone.
It wasn't just firing at the mass.
Not at random. Picking a target and rapid fire.
So you could presumably see the results. I mean, were you hitting the
target? Yes, you could see them toppling over.
How did you feel about that? I mean, you were wounded.
Good. It was enlightening to think that at least you were proving a point. This is where your training came in. Yep.
Did it cause you any qualms after the event, looking, you know?
I mean, we had a little bit of patter between ourselves. I said, we're doing well there, lads. I said, but keep our eyes peeled because Christ will be coming again. It's all right. We're ready for him. We're ready for him, Sarge. Don't worry. We'll give him some fucking stick when they come down again, if they come. That's the attitude we got in.
So it's a very upbeat.
Good fighting spirit, you know. Yeah.
Did you suffer many casualties yourself during the first attack?
No, I don't think so. No.
The second attack was the second attack. You were only using small arms, were you?
Yeah.
So that was your Lee Enfield.
Lee Enfield and Bren. Yeah.
Now, how was that? You wouldn't be firing the Bren yourself?
No, the Bren gunner was next to me, and he's number two, and I was in a kneeling position firing, and some of them were lying in the prone position, which is a good position to be in. As a matter of fact...
Along the top of the embankment, do you mean?
Well, we were forward of the embankment, and we were more or less covering in front of the... we weren't in the farmhouses. We were outside of the farmhouse.
And you weren't in trenches?
We worked anywhere we could, in the gullies, you know what I mean, the drainages and all that, and all flat.
So your defensive, they just improved natural things, had they? It wasn't like a trench line.
Well, we made use of the natural cover that was available. All right, Pete?
And what was the Bren gun like? I mean, as a machine gun?
Good.
In action?
Good, because you could get it, you could sweep. You could traverse with the Bren gun, you know. Traverse left and right and forward. We put a good spraying power down.
And it was accurate?
Oh, yes.
Was it better than... I mean, you'd seen it in action rather than the Lewis. It would be better than the Lewis.
Yeah.
Did it have any mechanical problems that you noticed during that action?
No, it was all right.
It was jam-free?
No, jam-free. Everything went perfect.
So you they wouldn't get close enough for hand grenades, so you would
no.
You didn't. What about your 3-inch or is it 2-inch mortars? Did you have any support from your battalion mortars?
Well, our mortars were situated away from my platoon. I suppose they had their targets to fire on as well. You see,
but not as far as you were concerned, they weren't there.
No, we kept it with small arms fire.
And did you have any artillery support at all?
No. No artillery support.
Now, what were the Germans using on you when they saw you, when they could find you?
Well, when they knew we were strong, then they started putting artillery and their mortar fire down.
So during the first attack, you were just getting small arms back, were you?
Yes. You see, the Germans, their first attack was just a probe. Probing the enemy positions from their point of view, you see. And
but it was a strong attack to you.
What? Yes.
Relative that to how many people?
That's right. You're right there, Peter. Yes, it was. And the same applied on the second attack. On the second attack, you see, there must have been some mortar fire put down on the left hand, the left farmhouse. On the second one. And that was it, you see, that's when Mr. Peel was killed. And Sergeant Fisher was badly wounded by mortar fire. Because rifle fire was ineffective.
For the Germans?
Yes. Because, say, well, they suffered casualties. Because they were lying all over the place, the Germans were lying dead. And, partially wounded behind. We got one German soldier, he was wounded in the knee in the second attack, and we brought him back to the farmhouse that I was occupying, and one of the lads went in, got a chair and set him down. He was only about 18 or 19, fair hair, you know, a real Aryan German, a little he must have had a service medal, had a ribbon on, I remember that. And he was trembling like a leaf. Oh, he was shit scared, he was. And we searched around and got his field dressing and slit his trousers up, you know. And I put a field service dressing on, he'd been shot through the knees, put one on, and he was trembling all the time. And one of our lads, he put his rifle down beside, like just like that. And while I was dressing, I said, get that rifle away from where he is. And he said, oh, bloody hell. He said, aye. And so he got his rifle and slung it like. He watched me put this field dressing on a German, young German, and I remember Blanche, Private Blanche, he was talking to the German prisoner of war. He says, that's nothing, that lad. He says, wait till we get you back there. He says, we'll give you more than that. And you get more than that, bugger, when you get further back, when we take you back to where you're going. The prisoner, like, you know. I said, oh, I said, stop the bloody tackle. I said, he doesn't understand the word he's talking about. He says, oh, but he's shit frightened, isn't he, Sergeant? I said, of course he is. Wouldn't you, in his position? He'd have thought we were going to shoot him. Anyway, got the German prisoner back.
So that was in between the two attacks?
Yeah.
He was the only prisoner you saw, I presume?
Well, he was the only one that was able to make himself known he was alive, you see. If he'd laid possum where he was, pretended to be dead, his own men would have picked him up, you see. But he moved and went to him and... was it that all?
Between the attacks, did you make any other special preparations? Other, you know, you'd ask for more support, or at least to have the platoon ready.
Yes, that's right.
But you didn't get that. Were you able to do anything else to strengthen your position?
No, we just kept in the same positions as we were. We didn't even have to regroup because we hadn't any casualties except on the second attack, you see. I think we've mentioned that before. Yeah. And it was in the morning of the 28th and the last attack that I was wounded. The Germans, they really got down to the business of clearing the area, choose what to come. That was my opinion about it. And I remember I was standing up at the time and going forward to have a look at the lads in their positions, see if everything was all right. And the first thing I knew, I was struck in the back with a mortar piece, you know, in the air, about 3 yards forward and flat on my face. And I knew I was wounded because I could feel the blood pumping out the wound. And I lay there, and I was quite numb at the time. And Private Hurst, when it quietened down, Private Hurst came to me and pulled me up, and he helped me to go back, and he put me in a small empty dugout. And he got my field service dressing, and he's putting it on, and I remember looking sideways, and I saw the Major and the Sergeant Major.
Cousins, you mean?
Yeah. And you could see what would happen. He'd never turn sideways, and he'd ever come over and say, hello, what's happened? Are you all right, Sergeant Ray, or anything like that? He just went to see what had really happened after I'd been carried back. In the meantime, Blanche had been killed.
So he went up to take over.
Well, he had
direct control.
He had nobody behind him except the Sergeant Major at first. And I thought, well, I'm out of it now. I can't do anything more. And I learnt later that from Private Hurst, Private Blanche was killed. Lance Corporal Nelson, he was killed. And while I was being dressed, there was two people supporting Sergeant Fisher. He was badly wounded. He couldn't speak. And he was being taken back to the BHQ to be passed on to the RAP, which is a regimental first aid post, you see. After I had the dressing on, Private Hurst, he helped me to get to BHQ. That was a big farmhouse in the rear, and it took me into the it was a big barn, And while I was in the barn, the Germans are really giving the area plastering with artillery. And they must have been firing incendiary shells as well, because the men in BHQ, every man that could handle a rifle, they were up on the where the eaves were inside the barn and firing at random across the area in front of them, because there's open ground coming towards the railway there, you see. And the RSM, he got pushing a GS wagon, and it was loaded, it was full of ammunition. This was the battalion's ammunition, I should think, and there were all sorts. There'd be small arms, there'd be grenades and all sorts in there, he's pushing it out the road. And the colonel, he sent word in with the adjutant. He sent word in the adjutant, Tommy Stallard, and he said, anyone who can possibly manage to get out of this situation, they are welcome to do so, and I urge you to do so urgently. Get yourselves out of it as soon as you possibly can, if you can. Well, I was in the predicament, I didn't know whether to walk or crawl till I tried. And there was one sergeant in there, he had a wound in his knee, I think. And he managed to get up and started hobbling around. I got up the best I could. I found that I could partly crawl and walk. And I started off and to the rear. I said, well, I'll try and make the best of it as far as I can get. And I crossed a small canal bridge, and I had to pull myself along there. And even when I was going along that canal bridge, the small arms fire was twanging off the girders. It was under fire as well. How I got through that, I do not know. Anyway, I got across mercifully, and I couldn't get any farther, and it was flopped down. And somebody out the RAP must have seen me, and they went out and dragged me into the RAP. And I think it was a corporal. He's one of our own men. I think they called him Victor Gunn. That was his name. He had a look at my field dressing, and he looked out and said, I think you're all right there, Jim. He said, we've got a PU coming up just now. He said, we'll get you out there as soon as possible. I waited in there about 10 minutes and the PU arrived, and we loaded in there ship shape and any fashion, and off we went down towards the dockland area, you know.
So your impression as you left was that the St. Vinet position was being overrun?
Yeah, definitely.
Or was in the process of being?
Yeah. Old battalion hadn't a chance. The Germans had everything. They thrown everything at our battalion.
Did they use air attacks at all?
No, it wasn't necessary. I think they were using the air attacks mainly on over Britain. I think they were. And
where did you go in the ambulance? How many were there in there?
There were about eight of us.
Was it actually an ambulance?
No,
it's just a truck.
A personal utility truck. Yes, that's what it was. A 1500 liter, something like that. And a piece of bumpy ground, like, and every bump was painful. And we got towards the dock, outside the dock area, and we offloaded.
At Dunkirk?
At Dunkirk, yes. And they brought us off and got us into an abandoned school. And I was put in a classroom on a stretcher. And there were several wounded people in there. There were civilians in there as well. Men, women and children. Casualties. And there's one man beside myself, I don't know what regiment he was in. And you know, his foot, his foot was badly shattered. The medical staff, I think they had quite a hell of a job on Peter, because there were emergency operations and all sorts going on, even with the bombardment being carried on in the Dockland area. The Germans are converging on it that quickly, on the docks. As a matter of fact, prior to this, what I was going to say, the chap lying next to me, who due for his to go in for an operation.
What, the one with the foot?
But it was an amputation. And Sam, he was a Royal Army Medical Corps orderly. I only knew him by Sam because I heard his name called by one of his mates. And he come in and he said, "Right, Sarge," he said, when they bring this one back, being beside you, he said, "Try and pacify him, really," because before he took him in, he was talking to me, this soldier. He said, "Good God," he said, "I hope they don't take this foot off." He said, "I don't know what I'll be able to do in civilian life, you know, the way it's going to be." I said, "Don't worry about taking your foot off." I said, "You're alive." I said, "You're alive, and thank God you're alive. Never mind having your bloody foot off, lad." I said, "I'm wounded as well." I said, "I don't know whether I'll get out here or not." And he pacified him, and they took him in, and it was an amputation. So Sam come, he said, "Now when they bring him out," he said, "when, if he comes round, keep him quiet." He said, "He'll be under shock." And all, I said, "Talk to him, pacify him and keep him quiet." I said, "Right though, Sam." And Sam, in the meantime, he said, "Have you had anything to eat, Sarge?" I said, "No." I said, "I've had nothing to eat." He said, "For God knows when." I said, "Are you hungry?" I said, "Not particularly." He said, "But look," and he gives us a big round loaf, a dark brown bread with a big number four carved in it, and only before it was baked. He said, "Look," he said, get this." He said, "Try and eat some food," he said, "if you can." And anyway, he said, "What you can't eat," he says, let the rest of the people in the classroom have it." So I said, "Right, what's up?" So I tore a piece off, and I held the bread up like, and little hands were going up here and there, and I was tearing chunks out and slinging it across. I couldn't walk over, because normally, chucking it across, and it was bouncing on the floor, and then and that was it. They brought this chappy out, and I was watching him like, and he woke up, and I just put him on, and I said, "Are you all right then, Cock?" I said, you've been in and out." I said, and he looked like, and he looked down, he said, "Oh, Christ," he says, "they've took me bloody foot off." And he just fell back, and he died dead. That's all he said. "They've took me bloody foot off." And he just went back, gone. Sam came, and I told him, he said, "Well, we expected it anyway." So he put the blanket over his face. And 10 minutes, a quarter an hour later, I could see them all scurrying, you know. I said, "Sam, what's going off?" He said, "Bloody hell," he said, "you're," he said, "you're here," he said. "Hang on," he said, "I'll get you out." And so the stretcher I was lying on, they picked it up, took me out, pushed me in an ambulance, and I went down to the dock side. And you know, Pete, those docks, they were crammed with not particularly our own men, you know what I mean, because there were Scots people there, they were all Scotsmen, and then they helped to carry me out to the ambulance and put me on the hospital ship, and it was the Oxfordshire. That was the hospital ship that took me on. And while I was in that ambulance, the square windows, you know, small square windows, I could see the salvos of German artillery being pumped into this hillside on the other side of the docks. And there must have been Moroccan troops over there called Spies. And they were milling around, running all over, and a horse came out of this wooded area on the top slope, and it was running around, and a shell went off and blew its bloody head clean off. I saw that action. And I got taken below deck, and all the cots were fixtures on the hospital ship, of course. And plunked me in there, and this was very, very late in the afternoon, and the sun was going down.
Now, when was this? Because your action had been on the 27th, 28th, first attack 27th, and then...
Yeah.
So you wounded on the...
28th.
So when would this, you went off on the Oxfordshire, do you reckon? Would it only be the next...
The night of the 29th.
So it'd only been a day that. Right. And you'd been taken. So, what happened next then?
Well, I was on the Oxfordshire on the ship, and of course it was getting dark. And one of the nurses came round like that and talking to me and. Said how I was. I said I was hungry, and said, when did you last have any meals? So I said, well, it's hard to tell. I said, I've had no meals for at least 4 days. Actually, 4 days, a good meal. And she went and got me the bowl of soup. She put me next to a pillar underneath my head, and I had that bowl of soup, and you know, it was like a banquet to me. And she came again, maybe more comfortable, because there's quite a number of casualties on that ship. And the sun went down, but the aerial bombing still continued, and it was so close, the bombs dropping in the harbour, in the water, the ship was bouncing, you know, it was heaving against the jetty. Thumping against the jetty and falling back. And it wasn't until about 11 o'clock at night she pulled away into the into the channel. And I couldn't sleep anyway. Dim blue lights, you know, on the road deck. And there was a broad gangway coming down, just down in front of me, and the nurse was sitting on the bottom stairs. She had a steel helmet on, she had a gas mask around her, and she was sitting. She sat there all night, and early in the morning at dawn, we pulled in at the port south of England. It wasn't anywhere near Dover, it was farther up the coast. It must have been like Heysham or somewhere like that. And when we got in, pulled in there, there was a train waiting for us. I brought off the ship onto the dockside. Instantly, there was nurses and voluntary aid department nurses, they came, auxiliaries. The first thing I got was a cigarette, and I got a little card. It's the first time I've been in, had any communication of writing to anybody in England, you know what I mean? And no pencil anyway, because half of me clothes took off me and things like that, you see. And she provided me with a pen.